we did get some measure of justice, but as I said in court today, there is no justice enough in this world.
A Kodiak man receives 4 life sentences for a double murder. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 8th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, more trouble for Diomede's regular helicopter transportation.
Every time they sparked up that bird, it was $10,000. So you can imagine, it got to the point it was pretty desperate out there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The man convicted of a 2012 double murder at the Kodiak Coast Guard base will spend the rest of his life in federal prison. 63-year-old James Wells was sentenced today to 4 consecutive life sentences in federal court in Anchorage. From KMXT in Kodiak, Jay Barrett has more.
During sentencing, as he has since he emerged as a suspect 2 years ago, James Wells maintained his innocence, saying he did not shoot to death his co-workers, Petty Officer First Class James Hopkins and retired Chief Petty Officer Richard Belisle. Wells, a retired Coast Guardsman himself, worked at the Kodiak Coast Guard Communications Station with Belisle and Hopkins. Before judgment was handed down, Wells said, quote, "We all suffered from this tragedy." His defense attorney, federal public defender Rich Kirtner, said the killer is still out there. However, Judge Ralph Beislein said the evidence was overwhelming, adding the real killer is sitting at the table in front of us. U.S. Attorney Karen Loeffler said after the sentencing that justice was served.
This was really one of the most planned, premeditated, and cold-blooded murders we've ever seen.
The federal prosecutor's case was largely circumstantial, as the murder weapon, a .44 Magnum handgun, was never found, and there were no witnesses to the crime. Nevertheless, the jury found him guilty of first-degree murder on April 25th, after deliberating less than a day. The widows of both men Wells killed also spoke at the sentencing. After what she called a very, very long 2 years, Nicola Belisle said outside the courtroom that she felt empowered by the verdict and the sentencing.
We did get some measure of justice, but as I said in court today, there is no justice enough in this world. And I just hope and pray that there will be in the next life, and God will deal out the appropriate justice for him, the ultimate justice. And I hope that he rots in prison and rots in hell. I actually got to say that to him, and I feel very good about that.
Wells was not arrested until 10 months after the murders while the FBI tried to build the case against him. Belisle, who suspected Wells all along because of problems between him and her husband, said she spent those months in fear for her life, sitting at home with a loaded firearm on her lap.
I thought he was going to come after us to try and stop the investigation. I couldn't leave my house if his truck was there, because I can see his house from ours. And if his truck was there, I was scared because I could, you know, he was right across the way from me. And if his truck wasn't there, well, then I couldn't leave the house because I was terrified that I was going to run into him somewhere.
Judge Beislein said the victims' families are due restitution, and Belisle says she wants ownership of the Wells home.
I want to burn it down. It needs to go away. That's my ultimate goal, so that I don't have to look at it for the rest of my life, and my children, my potential grandchildren, that they don't ever have to sit in our family home and see that house. And I don't think the members of our community need to see that house. You know, the people that live opposite him and next to him, that's my goal, and I've made no secret of that.
Calling him cowardly and that he committed the murders out of anger, envy, and jealousy, Judge Beislein sentenced Wells to 2 counts of life in prison without parole for both the murders of Belisle and Hopkins, and 2 more life sentences for the use of a firearm in a crime of violence. Before the trial started, the Justice Department chose not to seek the death penalty. Loeffler said she did not know where the Federal Bureau of Prisons would ship Wells, but it will be out of state as there are no federal prisons in Alaska. Wells has 14 days to appeal his sentence. With help from APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez, I'm Jay Barrett in Kodiak.
Transportation to one of Alaska's most remote communities has stopped because of a contract delay that's tying up funds. Helicopter flights to Diomede were suspended this week because of a complicated system of state and federal subsidies that expired June 30th, before the yearly reauthorization contract was signed. Rich Sewell is a planner with the Alaska Department of Transportation and says the money paying for passenger flights to and from Diomede each Monday, weather permitting, comes from three different sources.
There's part funding by USDOT matching dollar for dollar what the state of Alaska provides. And this funding just ensures that the air carrier gets to a break-even point. And like I said, the individuals have to pay an airfare.
The Diomede service is contracted through Ericsson Helicopters, formerly Evergreen, and is subsidized at about $340,000 a year. Passengers pay another $200 one way on top of that. Sewell says before weekly helicopter flights got subsidized, the situation was much worse.
Every time they sparked up that bird, it was $10,000. So you can imagine it got to the point it was pretty desperate out there. Say a mother would come in to Nome to deliver baby, and then the problem was how does she get back home to Little Diomede?
Diomede is one of three communities in Alaska served by a modified version of the Essential Air Service program set up in 1978 as a way of ensuring rural residents wouldn't be completely abandoned by commercial flyers. The community's contract has to be renewed every year. Last year, flights were halted for weeks while documents were being signed. According to Heather Handyside, spokesperson for Senator Mark Begich, who has pushed for many of the aviation programs serving bush communities, the holdup this time around was on the federal side.
Well, the funding structure looks sound and reliable, and they completed their negotiations, and a contract will be signed to make sure that the transportation will continue as normal service to Little Diomede.
As of this morning, federal DOT has issued an order finalizing details with Ericsson. The paperwork is on course to be settled in the next few days, and according to a pilot with Ericsson, if that's true, they could start bringing backlogged passengers to and from Diomede by the end of the week. The Alaska Dispatch and Anchorage Daily News websites today merged under a new name, Alaska Dispatch News. The new name will soon appear in the print edition as well. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Since Alaska Dispatch took over the Anchorage Daily News in early May, merging the two websites has been a top priority. So far, editor Tony Hopfinger says the transition to the new Alaska Dispatch News website has been fairly smooth. The process mostly consists of migrating content from the former Anchorage Daily News site to the renamed Alaska Dispatch News website. But he says more changes are expected in the future.
We'll still be tweaking things for the next several weeks, I think, and there are some features that we're trying to add back in that readers might be missing from ADN, and then also trying to keep the reader experience the way we had it for Dispatch fans as well.
Some of those missing features include the online Sudoku and crossword puzzles and the sunrise-sunset timer. Hopfinger says the decision to rename the organization Alaska Dispatch News was made in part to retain the ADN brand, as well as to better depict their mission and future goals.
The next focus here is how do we build out our news organization across the state? How do we cover more towns and more communities and more statewide news? So the name is very important to us, and it should reflect the state, not just reflect Anchorage.
To bolster their news coverage, Hopfinger plans on gradually stationing reporters in Alaska's hub cities, likely starting in Bethel, and eventually in Washington, D.C. as well. On Sunday, July 20th, the header of the print edition will change from Anchorage Daily News to Alaska Dispatch News. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kuskokwim dog mushers struggle to catch enough fish for their teams.
just going to have to work harder. We work for our food. We work for our fish. It's not going to be given to us.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
A new National Geographic Atlas of the World is coming out this fall, and it's already controversial. The 10th edition of the World Atlas depicts Arctic sea ice during a record low year. Some scientists say that's not representative. KTOO's Sarah Yu has more.
The depiction of Arctic sea ice in the Atlas is based on 2012 NASA satellite data.
The ice cover during the summer in 2012, which is the record low ice cover, is less than 50% of what it was in the 1980s.
That's Josefino Comiso, lead researcher of the NASA satellite study. He says that it's important to redraw the map since the Arctic is changing so rapidly. The map is controversial. It only shows multi-year ice, which doesn't melt during warmer seasons. Cartographers didn't want to include new ice because it might be too confusing. New ice is still important to the Arctic landscape, providing shelter for animals and reflecting solar energy. It also poses risks to Arctic ocean-going vessels. Andy Mahoney is an assistant research professor at the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
An ocean that's covered with first-year ice, which is going to be a bit thinner, it's still hazardous. You still can't take a non-ice-reinforced vessel into those waters.
Mahoney says showing an average of ice levels taken over a few years would make the map more representative than the record low year.
It's also a very political issue. I think it behooves everyone to do the best job they can to make sure that they're using relevant and representative data when drawing a line on a map, which can have profound implications sometimes.
New ice is becoming increasingly important to people in the Arctic, says UAF geophysics professor Hayo Eichen.
Nowadays, if you go up to Barrow towards the end of summer, the closest ice may be several hundred miles away. You have open ocean out there. And for people in Barrow these days, the first-year ice is just as important as the multi-year ice.
But Arctic ice is changing so rapidly, the cherry-picking argument may be moot in a few years, Eichen says.
10 years from now, we might say, well, why did they pick 2012 when there was still so much ice left? You know, why aren't they updating this so much more quickly?
The new atlas comes out September 30th. In Juneau, I'm Sarah Yu.
A new study indicates that the death of a wolf has implications for the rest of the pack, depending on the size of the pack and the dead wolf's sex. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the study is in response to the legal trapping of a breeding female that was part of a well-known wolf pack that was frequently spotted in Denali National Park.
In 2012, a local trapper took a breeding female from the Grant Creek wolf pack that was known to den near the Denali Park Road. A second female died and no wolf pups survived that year. A new study suggests the death of those breeding females resulted in the pack's dispersal.
We found that most cases where a pack ended, there was the loss of a breeder beforehand.
Bridget Borg is a wildlife biologist with the National Park Service at Denali National Park and Preserve.
We saw that when packs are small, and when it's a female that died, or if the deaths occur during the pre-breeding or breeding season, the packs are more likely to end.
Borg and colleagues used data from a long-term study of wolves in the park to identify breeding wolves and find out what happened to packs when they died.
Our research kind of increases our understanding of the conditions under which the death of a breeder will have more of an impact on pack fate.
The study indicates that the dissolution of a single wolf pack may not have adverse effects on the overall wolf population. Scientists believe wolves may compensate in some cases for the death of a breeder by increasing reproduction the following year or by replacing a lost breeding wolf if the pack is large enough. A survey of wolves in Denali this spring turned out the fourth lowest total count of wolves since biologists started keeping track nearly 30 years ago. This year's count also shows low population density and smaller average pack sizes. Park Superintendent Don Stryker says in a press release that those numbers raise concerns about the harvest of wolves from packs that reside primarily within the park. Stryker points to implications for visitors who come to Denali to view a wolf in the wild. The new study appears online in the Journal of Animal Ecology. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
What kind of housing will Southeast Alaska communities need in the future? Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority is looking to answer that question with a housing needs assessment due out in September. The nonprofit says it will use the study to secure funds for housing projects, including some targeting rural and native communities. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
With about 1,200 year-round residents, Craig is the largest community on Prince of Wales Island in southern southeast Alaska. It's a hub for transportation and industry, like fishing and logging. Former Mayor Millie Schoonover says the town needs more affordable rental units.
There's a lot of building on the island, but they're private homes, people that are building their own homes, but there are a lot of people that prefer to rent.
Schoonover says that includes teachers, Forest Service employees, and people working seasonal jobs. She's also concerned about housing an influx of mine workers if the proposed Niblack and Boken Mountain mineral projects start operating on Prince of Wales. Schoonover is a landlord herself. She rents out the downstairs of her duplex and owns a 40-year-old mobile home in nearby Klawak that she hopes to sell. She's recently retired and sees a need for senior housing on the island as well.
A year ago this August, I took my elder brother up to Juneau to Wildflower Court. It's a beautiful, beautiful facility, but I can't afford to get up to see him very often.
Schoonover and a few dozen other Craig residents attended a recent meeting to provide input for Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority's Southeast Alaska Housing Needs Assessment. The Housing Authority offers programs that help people in the region with home ownership, affordable rentals, senior and transitional housing, and home improvement. Tlingit-Haida spokeswoman Joanne Wita says nonprofit housing agencies are facing leaner financial times.
There's more competition and less funding opportunities than there was in the past, and there is limited funding in the future, cuts that are coming our way.
Wita says the Housing Authority has beefed up home ownership programs in recent years. It now offers rent-to-own properties throughout Southeast, many of which are geared toward Alaska Natives and Native Americans. Based on the recent community meeting in Craig and another in Saxman, Wita says the nonprofit may need to focus more on affordable rentals.
The housing study will help us to identify where the greatest housing needs exist and determine if the population is wanting to rent or own housing based on what they can afford.
The Housing Authority contracted with Anchorage-based consultants Agnew Beck to do the assessment. Shanna Zuspan is a managing associate with the firm. These days, she says, nonprofit housing agencies need multiple funding sources.
It requires contributions from the local communities, from the residents of housing, and from various grant programs. So it's just critical that they understand their housing needs so they can develop the appropriate programs.
As part of the study, Agnew Beck and the Housing Authority are conducting a survey on Tlingit-Haida's website. Zuspan says the assessment will incorporate the results with existing studies, like a statewide housing needs report recently released by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority's study will focus on Craig and Saxman, but include information about the region as a whole. Wita says the assessment will be updated periodically with the needs of other Southeast communities. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Nana Regional Corporation, and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Dog mushers in remote Alaska are breathing a sigh of relief as fishing restrictions are being relaxed on the Kuskokwim River. Mushers along that western Alaskan river feed their dogs fish, but this year, because of the restrictions, they got a late start. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Bethel musher John Simon's 24 or so huskies eat at least 8 medium-sized salmon each day. That can include bony parts from the coveted king salmon.
I was worried about getting more fish for the dogs, because when we're fishing for kings, you know, we usually have heads and backbones, stuff like that, and we didn't have that this year.
That's because fish managers are trying to protect the dwindling king salmon population on the Kuskokwim by restricting most mesh nets. That means mushers like Simon have also been unable to catch chum salmon, also known as dog salmon, a main staple of a Kuskokwim sled dog's diet. 30 miles upriver in the village of Akiak, 16-time Iditarod racer Mike Williams Sr. in his native language says hardships are a part of a musher's life. Despite this year's setback, he says he and his family will continue to provide for the dogs.
If they have no food, then they will have no food, but we will gather scraps if we have to.
In nearby Guithluk, musher Max Olick says he'll rely more than ever on his community and his own money to get his team through the long winter.
We start to run short around spring, in April. These dogs have a tough appetite. The food can sustain them longer if you also use commercial dog food. This is more expensive, but all mushers around here know that food comes with a price, either in our store or down the river.
Back in Bethel, John Simon is planning on spending extra hours on the river to make up for lost time.
Just gonna have to work harder. We work for our food. We work for our fish. Our ancestors did it. That's the way it is in our culture. You have to work for it. It's not going to be given to us.
Simon and the other mushers will get that chance. Fish managers have opened up the river now that the majority of kings have passed through. Now mushers will face a new race, a race to hang and dry enough chum and coho salmon to keep their team strong for the winter racing season. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
A determined woman named Louise Kellogg established a dairy farm in Palmer in the days after World War II. Now Spring Creek Farm honors her legacy with educational programs. Alaska Pacific University manages the land and is balancing expanding the farm's viability as an educational center with keeping its open spaces undisturbed.
That's a fun game!
A dozen or so 5- and 6-year-olds are playing a game in the shade of a gnarled apple tree. The game involves a frog and a detective somehow. It's part of a summer program at Spring Creek Farm. When a former pilot and Women's Army Corps veteran decided to take advantage of homesteading opportunities in Alaska after World War II, local Palmer colonists laughed. But a decade later, Louise Kellogg's dairy farm became the most successful in the area. Before her death, Kellogg put 700 acres into a trust and offered its management to Alaska Pacific University. Steve Rubenstein, APU's director at the farm, says the farm environment is the classroom setting for the university's unique Master of Science in Outdoor and Environmental Education program.
When we first started the program, the primary focus really was teachers working in the school system, perhaps, who wanted to do more environmental education with their classes but needed the extra training to do so. People that were looking to work for agencies developing curriculum for, you know, places like the Miri Science Center or Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife.
APU operates Spring Creek as a satellite campus and is attempting to further the farm as an educational asset. Plans are in the works to eventually house a charter high school on site with an emphasis on outdoor education and natural resource skills. Currently, the farm is home to Louise's Farm School, named in honor of Kellogg. Megan Rock is the coordinator at the farm school, and she shows me around.
So, like I said, this was an old chicken coop that has been converted. So this is where our younger students, this is where our chickadees classes are conducted.
The farm school serves homeschooled children ages 5 through 13.
And they learn about using their five senses to experience the outdoors.
Rock works with three companies that provide correspondence courses for homeschooled kids. Louisa's Farm School just received a state agricultural division grant for 2014. Rock says the funds will be used to develop curriculum to teach youngsters about local foods and local farms. She calls it place-based education.
The long-term projects that we're working on are really allowing students to experience learning in different ways.
The kids will learn about farming from seeds to harvest.
A little bit dark, so just watch your step.
We go down to the basement of Louise's original house where seeds are sprouted under grow lights.
Oh my word!
Yeah, so early April, this place is humming. It's really neat for the kids to be able to come in here and see this happening and understand, what...
Outside, an early spring has coaxed lettuce, kohlrabi, and scallions to sprout in neat rows. Nearby, the farm's grower, Josh Valor, is guiding volunteers who are planting pepper seedlings in a hoop house. He says the farm's programs are right in line with the current get kids outside and moving trend.
It's really important. I mean, we're looking at a new diabetic generation, and the work here is extremely healthy. Getting kids out into the fields to do the labor and to understand where food comes from.
Although APU calls Spring Creek an educational farm, at present some acreage is leased for hay production, and the vegetable garden yields produce for local community-supported agriculture subscribers and an Anchorage farmers market. Round hay bales and idle reaping machines stand in the neat fields, although the dairy cattle are long gone. Steve Rubenstein.
This may well be one of the last acreages of its size this side of Palmer.
Rubenstein says Louise Kellogg would be proud that her farm is being used for a school.
She wanted this farm to continue, but also to continue as a place for kids of all ages, college on down, to have access to the natural world.
But Matanuska Valley farmland is under siege by developers, and Rubenstein says that 40 acres flanking the farm is already earmarked for housing. And he is only too well aware that if the farm were ever to become a financial burden to APU, the bulldozers would be standing at the gate. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Sarah Yu and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.